The 100 Years' War, the Poitiers period, King John's revenge. Paris was alive with rumors of rebellion and treason. There were reports of plots against the king as well as the Dauphin, and of conspiracies between the Dauphin and Charles of Navarre. Persistent gossip circulated about the King of Navarre's dealings with the English. At some point, John II was said to have received a cache of documents whose authenticity was hotly disputed, but appeared to disclose a scheme for murdering both him and his son and giving Normandy to Edward III. Towards the end of March 1356, the king was about to attend a baptism at the Cistercian Abbey of Beaupère near Beauvais. As he set out, he received information which suggested that the King of Navarre had devised a plan with the leading malcontents amongst the Norman nobility to kidnap him there and put him to death. It is difficult to know how much truth there was in the story, but undoubtedly something was going on. But this latest incident festered in John's mind and coalesced with the accumulated grievances of the past 3 years. Out of his capital and away from calmer councils, he decided to have done for once and for all with Charles of Navarre and his Norman allies. John collected 100 men-at-arms from his household troops and a handful of his closest relations and friends. He sent to Paris for another 500 men to join him on the road. Then, without waiting for them to arrive, he led his men to Monville, a little village at the end of the forest of Lyon, some 30 miles east of Rouen. On April 5, 1356, they rose before dawn and rode through the vast forests of the Seine Valley towards the Norman capital. The Dauphin was presiding over a council of the leading men of Normandy at Rouen Castle. It had been called to make arrangements for the defense of the province during his absence at Languedoc. Charles of Navarre and the Count of Harcourt were there. So were most of the prominent noblemen of the province and the mayor and the leading citizens of Rouen. At midday, when the meeting had ended, the Dauphin entertained about 30 of them at a banquet in the main hall of the castle. In the middle of the meal, a door was opened in the corner of the hall. The king entered unannounced, wearing a battle helmet and full armor under his clothes. He was followed by his brother, the Duke d'Orléans, his son, the Count of Anjou, the Marshal Arul d'Aram, and a large body of armed men. They had entered by a stair tower, at the foot of which a small wicket gate leading into the meadows outside had been left open for them. Moving into the middle of the hall, the Marshal drew his sword from underneath his cloak and shouted, "Anyone who moves shall die." The king approached the high table where the Dauphin was sitting with the guests of honor. He grasped Charles of Navarre by the throat and pulled him bodily back from the table. "Foul traitor," he said, "you deserve to die." Charles's squire, Colin Doublet, who had undertaken the delicate mission to England for him in the previous summer, was serving as his carver. He drew a dagger from his clothes and was immediately disarmed by the soldiers. "My lord," the Dauphin protested, "what are you doing? These men are my guests. They are under my roof." The king was deaf to his protests. Charles and Doublet were dragged away. The other guests fled for the doors. A handful of them, including Thomas de Ladite, Chancellor of Navarre, escaped from the hall and managed to find their way out of the castle into the streets of Rouen, where excited crowds were beginning to gather. Most of the diners were stopped and held in separate rooms of the castle until the king's wishes were known. John singled out three men, the Count of Harcourt, the Lord of Granville, and Guillaume de Montmorency. The first two men were prominent in every Navarrese plot since the murder of Charles of Spain more than 2 years earlier. The third had been involved in the plan to take the Dauphin to Germany in December, and probably in the attempt to kidnap the king in March. They were summarily condemned to death. So was Colin Doublet, who had threatened John with his dagger in the hall. Towards the end of the afternoon, the gates of Rouen were closed, a curfew declared, and the streets emptied of their crowds. The four condemned men were put in two carts, taken out of the city to a large open space called the Champ du Pardon, where horse fairs were held. There they were beheaded in the presence of the king, with the greatest possible butchery, by an amateur executioner. He was a forger and a murderer awaiting trial in Rouen prison, who volunteered for the job so he could earn his pardon. When the deed was done, John had the bodies suspended from chains and their heads impaled on lances at the great gallows which overlooked the city of Rouen from the heights of Béarn on the Abbey Road. In spite of this terrible anger, John retained enough respect for the aristocratic convention to spare his son-in-law the same fate. Charles of Navarre was taken under armed guard to Paris with two of his closest retainers, Fierquat Fricamp and Jean de Patelou, both of whom had been employed in confidential missions on his behalf. All three men were interrogated at length in the cells of Châtelet. Fricamp's confession, part of which was extracted under torture, of course, uncovered much of the complex dealings with Charles and the king's enemies over the past few years. The full extent had never previously been appreciated by John's ministers. He eventually escaped from the Châtelet with the aid of two of his servants and found his way to England. As for Charles himself, he was moved from prison to prison for greater security. He lodged briefly in the Louvre, the Châtelet, the huge fortress of Chateau Gaillard, and at L'Adelais on the Seine, as well as the Citadel on Pontoise. When the English invaded Normandy in June, he was taken out of the kingdom to the French protectorate of Cambrai. There they shut him up in the great keep of Arleux, a remote and austere old fort surrounded by marsh, where he remained in close confinement for more than a year and a half. John's revenge at Rouen must have been profoundly satisfying to him, but it ended up being an act of great folly. The summary execution without trial of the head of the leading noble house of Normandy was profoundly offensive to the aristocratic sentiment, even among those whose every instinct was to support the king. It outraged opinion in the province close to Paris, which had a strong sense of political identity, and whose wealth had contributed mightily to the French war effort for two decades. It threw the House of Évreux, which had hitherto been extremely chary in its dealings with the English, into the English hands, provoking a schism within the royal family and a bloody civil war in western France. To the many in Normandy and elsewhere who remembered the sudden execution of the Count of Eu in 1350 and knew nothing of the conspiracies of Avignon, Beaupré, or the bridge at St. Cloud, it confirmed the widespread impression that King John was irrational, unstable, and impulsive, that his government lived every day from one expedient to the next. A more skillful politician than John II might have turned opinion in his favor, but John took the authority of his office for granted. Shortly after the event, he made it known that the Count of Harcourt had been arrested for treasonable dealings with the English, and claimed they have documents to prove it. In May, a statement of the case against Harcourt was prepared and distributed in Normandy, with presumably said much the same thing. But the arrest and the imprisonment of the king's son-in-law was too shocking to the pieties of 14th-century politics, and the reasons too sensitive and humiliating to be discussed in public. John never explained them. No one knows what led to his arrest. The spokesman of the Estates General complained when months afterwards the consequence of the king's anger was plain for all to see. The French king was well aware he'd planned his coup that the strongholds of the House of Évreux and his allies in Normandy would have to be taken by force. On April 7, 1356, 2 days after the execution of the Count of Harcourt, 80 mounted men commanded by the Bailey of Rouen seized the castle of Harcourt in the valley of the Rille. During the next 2 weeks, the 500 men-at-arms who had been summoned from Paris before the coup arrived at Pont de l'Arche with the provost of the merchants of Paris, Étienne Marcel. Others were mustered in small groups across the province. As the king returned to Paris with his prisoners, his officers laid siege to Évreux and the citadel at Pont-Audemer. Évreux was the seat of Charles of Navarre's administration in France and was not particularly strong. The city, which was the kernel of the old town, was defended by low crumbling walls dating from late Roman times, reinforced by the castle of the counts at one end and the cathedral of Notre Dame at the other. The bourg, which had grown up north of the town around the marketplace, had its own more modern walls. The defense of the place depended mainly on an unenthusiastic population of 3,000 and a determined garrison of Navarre soldiers, urged on by principal counselors of the King of Navarre. The Dauphin's marshals captured the bourg almost immediately, but was unable to dislodge the garrison. Dauphin took command of the operation in person. He had siege engines brought from Rouen. Impatient letters arrived regularly from the king in Paris. Bloody assaults achieved nothing. A month after the siege had begun, Evreux still held out. At Pointe aux Mers, progress was even slower. Robert Oudinot, who for many years defended the king's territory in the Garonne Valley, had become master of the royal archers. He was in command of the operation. As at Evreux, he was able to occupy the town without difficulty, but he made no impression on the keep. He undermined the walls, ordered one assault after the other, no success. 6 weeks later, his troops were still encamped. Of course, what happens next is, since Charles of Navarre is in prison, the defense of his territory is going to fall to his brother Philip, who's only 22 years old, and he will then begin trying to fight King John and his forces in the area. Of course, the whole time, Edward III is planning to invade this region. And of course, there's also the discussion of another Givenchy led by the Black Prince coming out of Bordeaux and heading north. So this is a very inopportune time for the king to be messing with an internal civil war issue. I would point out that when we started the Hundred Years' War, we have this issue of Edward III wanting to be king of France. Now we're in a position where we have, you know, Charles of Navarre, who's been plotting to become the king of France. This will continue as we go through the Hundred Years' War, as different factions within France will take up the same gamble. The Dukes of Burgundy will be the last ones to be involved in an attempt for themselves to become the king of France. So it couldn't get much more confused than it is at this particular point. That's saying a lot for what we've covered so far in the Hundred Years' War. The sources for this: The Hundred Years' War by Pirois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylands, The Hundred Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.